Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. I started this blog talk show a couple of years ago to expose the injustices in America and in the American penal system. As we all know it well to be known in the United States, that this country is the only country in the world that has mass incarceration. We are scheduled to have on with us today two very special and unique guests whom I will be introducing. And that is attorney Amina Matheny Willard and her twin sister paralegal Amira Matheny. Amina met, hold on a second, please, audience.
Yes.
You didn't get the invitation? Okay. Yes, I did. It's 657-383-1630. This is attorney Matheny calling in now, and she will be in the studio in a few minutes, everyone. Thank you. I guess that's a sign of a very busy attorney. But anyway, Amina Matheny Willard has been a criminal defense attorney for over 21 years. She began her career with a focus on juvenile criminal defense and has been instrumental in shaping the way defense attorneys practice by helping to develop the juvenile standards of practice distributed by the Virginia Indigent Defense Commission and by presenting to defense attorneys throughout the Commonwealth. She has been fighting for Virginia residents who have been over-targeted, overcharged, and over-incarcerated. And she is fighting to reverse the trend of over-incarceration of minorities in this country. The focus of her law firm is criminal defense and civil rights litigation. This is what many of us as advocates and families with incarcerated loved ones are focusing on, the injustices in America of mass incarceration and racial disparity. We have a real problem in this country, and as many of you know, I've been interviewing some people from abroad, from other countries, who have actually come on. Miriam Jacobs, for one, who is a psychosocial therapist from the Netherlands. She has been in the American prisons, and she has also been volunteering in the prisons in the Netherlands. She herself has witnessed what we all, and many of you in the audience may not have, but she has witnessed the injustices that go on in this country. And she has also discussed the psychological damage to many of our incarcerated individuals, our loved ones behind those prison walls, who are being detained in solitary confinement, who are being kept on restrictive housing units, who are being abused, deprived, provoked, harassed, medically, psychologically, even spiritually neglected. There is so much injustice going on in this country and in our prisons, and something needs to be done about it. We have people, even in Massachusetts, and coalitions that are working on solitary confinement and also working on restrictive housing units, which I know for a fact there are people in these units who have done nothing wrong and were placed there out of revenge. Hold on a second, please. Hello? 657-383-1630. Okay, and I will also send the invitations again. Okay. Sorry, audience. We are having a little bit of confusion here today, but we will get it straightened out in a few minutes. Okay. Sometimes when the invitations are sent out, the guests sometimes don't get them, and it causes more confusion. But Miss Matheny will be on with us in a few minutes. Okay, here we go.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Is this attorney Mabini Willard. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes, Amina Matheny Willard.
Oh, Matheny, I am so sorry. And it is so good to have you on the show with us. I really and truly am honored to have you on with us.
Thank you so much.
Attorney Willard, I was just letting the audience know about some of the work that you've been doing throughout the 21 years that you've been an attorney. And I'd like to have you speak a little bit more on your the work that you are doing. And again, I want to thank you. And audience, there was a little bit of confusion, but as I mentioned, sometimes invitations get sent out and the guests do not get them on time, or they don't get them at all and they have to be sent out again. So I am so sorry that there was such a delay in this, but please do introduce yourself and tell a little bit about yourself.
Okay. My name is Amina Matheny Willard. I've been a criminal defense attorney for over 21 years. The majority of my career, I have been in various public defender offices. So when I graduated from law school, I started in the Petersburg Public Defender's Office in Virginia, and then I went to the Virginia Beach Public Defender's Office, the Chesapeake Public Defender's Office. I was in private practice for about 6 years, and then I went to the Norfolk Public Defender's Office. Right now, I'm in private practice again, and I am focusing my practice on civil rights litigation.
And that's a perfect field. That's a perfect area to be focusing on right now in this day and age in this country, because there is so – it has been an ongoing thing within the penal system with the racial disparity.
Yeah.
But it's even – it's gotten so much worse than ever before as far as the racial issues in this country. And it's very important that there are people like yourself that are keeping the focus on these issues and in this direction. So I really admire what you're doing. And can you just talk about some of the cases, without mentioning names, some of the types of cases that you have come in contact with?
Yes. Well, actually, I have a case right now that's in the news. So her name is already out there, but I'm representing a young lady named Ebony Holmes, who was punched by a Norfolk police officer, Officer Vincent Taco, during a traffic stop. What happened is she was the designated driver. It was 4th of July, around 1 in the morning, so it was like July 5th. But she was the designated driver, and she was transporting her friends to from one party to another party, and she didn't have anything to drink. He stopped her for speeding. When he stopped her for speeding, from the body camera footage, you can tell that he was just very aggressive. He's a white male officer. And ultimately, he told her to get out of the vehicle. When she tried to get out of the vehicle, he pulled the door open and punched her in her face, dragged her out the vehicle. She was arrested. And just to be clear, when the officer told her to get out of the vehicle, she opened the door. The officer was in front of the door, and he tried to get a felony assault and battery charge against her for hitting him with the door. And the magistrate basically said, no, you told her to open the door. She opened the door, and she did not intentionally hit you with the door. So he was not able to get the felony warrant, but we're going to court now on reckless driving, and he did charge her with misdemeanor obstruction of justice for really no reason at all.
They always find something. If they can't find one way, they will find another way to justify the inappropriate action that they do. I was watching
right.
the news the other day, and there was a driver that was recently shot by the police, and it was unusual because this was a white man driving the car, but he wouldn't get out. Mm-hmm. The officer kept saying, get out of the car, get out of the car. But he shot the man while he was in the car. So it's getting to the point now where they're getting away with so much that they're going beyond even the people of color, which is the primary ones that they're always targeting. And to this day, they
right.
have shot so many people. So, but it just surprised me that this person here was shot and he was white. But I will say, a lot of people are afraid when they are stopped by the police now. They're afraid to stop A lot of them are afraid to get out of their cars because they know that so much of this is occurring in law enforcement that it's becoming frightening to them. And I know that you have seen a lot of this, and I'm sure that you have represented a lot of people that have gone through some of these things.
Absolutely. And I always tell people, so first, another aspect that I can touch on, although I'm not an expert in this, there is a professor named Dr. Christine Hennepin, who actually talks about how police encounters can cause hypertension, diabetes, mental conditions. It's post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of police encounters. So what's happening really around the country is when you say people are afraid of being of the police encounter, there sometimes there's actually physical things that go on. Sometimes people get, my son actually, when he's around police officers, he actually physically gets, starts hyperventilating, shakes, gets upset when they're just around.
Exactly.
So this fear can affect us physically. it's really a tragedy. I usually tell my clients or anybody that's looking for the types of charges that officers bring, what I call them contempt of cop charges, but these are charges that they charge people with when they really don't have anything to charge them with. And those include resisting arrest, obstruction of justice, disorderly conduct, person abuse, assault and battery on law enforcement. Those are charges that I tell people, if you have those charges and nothing else, usually what happens in that case is an officer is not doing what they're supposed to do, basically confronting someone who doesn't want to be confronted, who they have no probable cause to stop, and then the person tries to leave and the officer gets upset. And the reason I say that, if you think of somebody like, let's say you think of somebody stealing candy at 7-Eleven, right? Well, when the police are called, if the person runs from them, then you're going to have a petty larceny and then maybe obstruction of justice. But a lot of times you just have obstruction of justice. So where's the underlying alleged crime? If you have petty larceny and obstruction of justice, that's one thing. But if you just have an obstruction of justice charge, that just really means you pissed off a cop. They probably had no business messing with you. And those are the kind of charges that officers are bringing. People are being found guilty of them, and then they have a record just because they didn't, want to stand there while officer talked to them, which they don't have to do. So the police officers are doing a lot. It seems like, unfortunately, it has gotten worse since the George Floyd incident, as opposed to getting better.
I see a lot of times when I was growing up, my parents taught us to respect the police, which we always did. But one of the things is when a police officer did something wrong, anyone in any kind of title at all did something wrong, to show them, to show the public that they would be held accountable, they would be getting a worse penalty than those that they put in prison, just to show that these people are supposed to be role models. They're not supposed to be criminals themselves. But it's reversed now. It's almost like they do a lot of these injustices and they get away with it. And they actually pat themselves on the back and they get so much support from their own superiors, which to me, and their union, which to me is very inappropriate and it's very wrong. It's not showing society that we have people that we can look up to and that we can trust. And I see this happening a lot now also in this country.
Right, I agree.
I wanted to say, I was saying the other day on the show, I was listening to the news, and there was a police officer recently he's on leave, they have him on leave, whether it's paid or unpaid leave, I don't know, but they found pornography and also that he was violating a little one in his own family in the shower. And so he's on leave. But the first thing that came out was his lawyer was saying, oh, he's a good guy. He's been a police officer for a while. He was in the military. He has PTSD. He said he needs help. And it really infuriated me because I personally have a loved one that was violated when he was 6 years old. And he's serving a life without parole now. And there are so many others that are served that are in prison that were violated, had traumatic experiences when they were kids and of color. And these people, because they have a title, because they are police officers, all of a sudden they're good guys. You know, they've never been in trouble before. They did this and they did that. Well, lo and behold, we have loved ones incarcerated who were in college in their final year of four-year college. They worked since the age of 14 years old. They've never been involved with substances, but they disclosed several months before they ended up committing their first crime, one fatal shot, and they get a life without parole. And it really upsets me that police officers, because they are in uniform, all of a sudden it's okay for them to molest children, to violate children, you know, to pornography. People are serving all this time in prison for things like that. And he is a police officer, and all of a sudden he's the good guy. I've heard others throughout the years, I've heard others who have been in high positions, whether they be judges, whether they be police officers, correctional officers, prison officials. When they do something wrong, it's always they're a good guy. They've never been in trouble before. And I tell everyone they should not stereotype prisoners because every situation is different. Prisoners are all different. And there's a lot of them. There's a large population of people incarcerated who have never been in trouble before. They were good people. The same thing that I'm hearing from these lawyers and these superiors of these people getting in trouble because they have uniforms. It's frustrating to listen to these kind of post-traumatic stress. There's so many people in prison with PTSD, but they talk about police officers and military men with PTSD. There's a lot of people incarcerated with PTSD that were violated as children that went through an awful traumatic background, and yet whenever they get diagnosed, the majority of times they get diagnosed, they're diagnosed, evaluated as being antisocial or having antisocial behavior rather than what the real fact is. They are PTSD. They label prisoners that way all the time, and it's frustrating. I've been advocating for the incarcerated for 25 years now, and we were doing national at one time, working with the men, women, and the youth. Whatever the case may be, death row, life without parole, people serving long sentences, short sentences, we did a lot of extensive research to find them transitional housing, to find them counseling, to find them finance, all these things. And these things today, now I focus my end on Massachusetts only, although the NBO moved on in doing other things for other areas. But it just it infuriates me that so many people get away with it just because they have titles, they're in uniform, or they're in power in government.
Right. And that's, you know, that's unfortunate. And it's just, it's something that we just need to change by talking about it. Your show is awesome. Just shedding light on it and then, you know, requiring that people do better is basically, you know, what we need to do.
We need more lawyers like yourself because there are lawyers out there that even prisoners and their loved ones cannot trust. And there are lawyers that will take advantage of a difficult situation. There's these producers out there that they talk about all the violence that goes on in this country, and yet there's producers out there that make movies out of the blood, sweat, and tears of other people, the tragedies that happen in them. And people are paying all kinds of money to go to these movies to see all this violence when, in fact, they're against it. They want people to go to prison. They want the death penalty. They want all these things to go on, but yet they're paying all this kind of money to watch this kind of violence. It's like a catch-22, or it's like giving mixed messages.
Yeah, and both of them are bad, you know, whether you're, if you're giving mixed messages, it just needs to be, we need to focus on treating people with compassion and more humanity. And I think that'll make a difference. And educating people as well.
So what have you worked with the juveniles for the 21 years, or have you been involved with others, women, men, adults?
Yeah, so the first 10 years of my career, I was just in juvenile court. I was the various, so the I guess the first two, it was juveniles in juvenile court. So I was a juvenile defense attorney. I did a lot of teaching to other attorneys about juvenile defense and how to handle their cases. After that, I did juvenile court. I did adults in juvenile court. So the contrast is when you're a juvenile defense attorney, you're representing children that have committed crimes. But also in Virginia, you have adults that are charged with crimes against minors. So I was representing people who had raped minors or sodomized them or beat them up or kidnapped them. So it was a drastic, you know, it's like a complete opposite, but it's still representation. And I believe that everyone deserves good representation. That's what the Constitution requires. So my focus was on juvenile criminal defense first few years, and then now I'm going into civil rights litigation, and there are juveniles involved in that as well. There's a lot of rights that are taken from juveniles in school. I can tell you one of the worst violations right now in Virginia that we're trying to fight against is when a child, let's say a child gets in a fight in school. In Virginia, they have school resource officers, which are police officers. The police officers cannot directly question the child. So what they do is the principal brings the child to the principal's office. The school resource officer or the police officer sits in the room while the principal questions the child. So that way, since the officer is not questioning the child, it's not an illegal interrogation. The officer takes notes, the principal questions the child, and then the principal hands the file over to the officer. The officer files charges against the child. So I'm trying to start a campaign where we tell children not to answer any questions when they are dealing with any disciplinary issues in school. Just don't give any statements. So we have to start doing that in order to protect our children. Parents, unfortunately, have to be educated because they are the you know, I don't want to, how do I say this? Let me just say what it is. Parents are always encouraging their children to tell the truth. So this is what I've seen in that scenario where a child is in school. The child doesn't want to talk. The parent comes in, tell them everything you know, Johnny. Tell them whatever you know. So then I'll have cases where I'm reading a transcript of a 17-year-old who gets caught by the police. The 17-year-old is in the police department saying, I don't want to talk for like 2 hours. Now, the police only have to stop questioning him when he says, I want an attorney. But if he says, I don't want to talk, he says that for 2 hours. Then they bring the mom in who's been sitting out there for 2 hours, and she's like, tell them everything. And the kid, well, I shot him. So now you got a confession with the help of mom, you know, or – what's worse is sometimes they'll send the mom in when the kid doesn't talk and the officers go out. The mom says, tell me what happened. Well, they're in the room by themselves, but every time you're in the police department, there is audio and visual recording. So now they got a confession to the mom that they use against the kid in court. So moms need to be educated, and dads too, but most of the time it's moms saying, tell them everything. Moms need to know to go in there, tell them don't talk. So officers cannot use moms as an extension, you know, an arm of the state, because I have seen so many parents just foil their child. Their child knows what they did. They're like, I'm not going to say anything. And mom is like, no, tell them the truth. Nothing's going to happen. Or just tell them or be, you know, if you want to confess, go to Jesus. Don't do it at the police station. That's
there
all.
You there you go. That's it.
But there's a lot of education. People just need to know that. And I know a lot of moms that I've talked to, and they have done it, but they don't know, you know. So it's not like, I'm not trying to make anybody feel bad, but really our children do not need to be talking to police. It never helps. If they have enough evidence to charge them, they're going to do it anyway. They don't need their help to convict our children. So that's something I'm working on here, trying to get kids in school not to talk to the principal when, you know, when they're brought down for discipline. They interview other kids, so it's not like they don't have the story. A lot of times there's video. They don't need any additional evidence from, you know, from that child. So even though it sounds kind of rebellious, this is where the school to pipeline starts in the schools, and this is how it starts. So
his name is Jeffrey Deskovic. He's a lawyer now. But I interviewed Jeffrey Deskovic, and he, when he was 16 years old, the police went to his house, and they took him to the police station without his mother or grandmother or whoever was his caretaker, without anybody. They took him to the police station, and they coerced him, and he ended up going to prison at the age of 17 on a rape conviction, and he was in for years before they found out through, I guess it was the Innocence Project, that he was innocent. That was all those years. But they took him to the police station without any adult, and he was a minor. He came out, he got his master's in criminal justice, and then he became a lawyer in New York. But these are another things that, you know, they question these kids. As you say, they do it in the school, they do it in the homes. But one of the things I notice is when a family has not been involved with law enforcement before, they will do whatever they can to help when they're being questioned, because they don't realize that they're being manipulated. What they're saying is going to be held against them. And it's going to be,
right.
In many cases, it's going to be turned around. It's going to be made worse than it was really initially told to them. And what are your thoughts on that? I know that you must have had situations in your cases with those types as well.
Yeah, so one thing, there's a huge misconception that the police need the consent of parents to question children. They don't. The Supreme Court has said that they don't. So children are not protected by the courts. Now, so what happens is parents have a false sense of security that if their child is ever taken to the police station, the officers are not going to talk to their child until they call them. There is absolutely no requirement that an officer call a parent before talking to a child. And they usually don't. What they do is they try to get as much information from the child as possible. If they can't get any information, they call the parent to get the information. And if they can get information, they call the parent after they've already got it. So there's no rule that says officers have to call parents before they talk to children in any setting, whether it's the school or the police department. Now there is a best practices that police departments use, and that best practices standard or the gold standard is that they do call parents before they talk to children. But you have to rely first on the fact that the police department has that gold standard in place, and most don't. And then even if the police department has that gold standard in place, because it's only a standard, it's not a law, it's not a requirement, then you have to realize that the officer that's dealing with your child is going to practice what the police department wants them to practice. So, again, there is no requirement that officers call parents before they talk to their children, ever. Mm-hmm. That's never been a requirement.
I didn't know that. I thought a juvenile or adolescent could not be questioned by the police without an adult with them.
Nope. But what I can tell you, so this is what I can say. First, that's what we have to teach our children. That's why we have to teach parents to teach their children not to talk to the police, because they're not always going to be there. What I can tell you is that if a child says, I want an attorney, the questioning is supposed to stop automatically. If they say, I want my mom, the questioning does not have to stop. The Supreme Court has said that if anyone asks for an attorney, the officers cannot question them, or they're not supposed to question them until an attorney is provided. So a child would have to know to say, I want an attorney. The other thing I was going to say is when you go to court, let's say there is a child that's being questioned by officers without the parent present. On a motion to suppress where you're trying to prevent that child's statements from coming in, the fact that a parent wasn't present is one element as to whether or not the confession is voluntary. But it's only one element. So it's not a requirement that the parent be present, but the judge can look at it and say, well, I don't think it was voluntary because the parent was present. But you can look at the statistics of the number of blacks that are in jail to know that judges don't really care they don't say, oh, I'm going to dismiss this whole charge because the parent wasn't present. That's never going to happen.
You know,
so,
really,
again, it's not required.
Yeah. It really upsets me to hear things like that because they want children to be children in one breath, and then they want them to be adults in another breath. And for them to bring children in, especially just because they're adolescents, you know, a lot of these young gang members, they're gang members because they're seeking role models and they're seeking someone that they can, you know, they can get some support from, some help from. And they don't have that. They don't have the role models like they used to. So they go to one another. And they, when two or more, they come together and they got all this frustration and anger inside of them. What happened? But a lot of times when they meet with the police, the police should not be allowed to question them, to talk to any of these kids without an adult. That's the way I feel, and I think any government official or leader, legislative member that votes for these kind of things, for these kids to be forced to talk to, especially in this day and age with these corrupt police officers, corrupt judges, corrupt prosecutors. We have a country that's full of corruption and lies, deception, you know, and they're going to put kids, it's almost like feeding them to the dogs. It doesn't make sense either.
Right. It's really, you know, it's more than disappointing in this country. You know, this is supposed to be America. We're supposed to care about laws and freedom. And, you know, we incarcerate more people than any other country in the world. And that's an embarrassment.
That's it. We have countries looking at this country, even with the human rights violation. We're not too far behind I don't know who has the highest rate of human rights violations, but we have quite a bit of it right here in this country. It's happening right in the prisons in this country. You know, it's happening in Massachusetts. People are being kept in solitary confinement on restrictive blocks with no justification. Many of them 22 hours a day. They're let out two hours a day like animals. They're having their belongings taken from them. You know, they don't have anyone advocating for them. We have so many people in this country, American Civil Liberties Union, they have it all over their website that they do something with human rights violation and civil rights, but yet they turn everyone down every single time. You know, there's a lot of law firms like that. These injustices going on in this country, and there's no oversight in the penal system, no oversight whatsoever. And I think the government needs to stop focusing on an independent committee to go into these prisons and into the courtrooms, you know, to oversee what's going on with the prosecution and with the judges. Because, again, in the 25 years I've been advocating, I've seen a lot of it with the clients that are seeking help and that are getting stepped all over. People vote for the death penalty, and look what's happening with the death penalty. People are being executed only to find out later down the road that they were innocent. And who is held accountable for that?
Right. No. And what is the accountability worth? I mean, if the person is already dead, and I'm opposed to the death penalty because the system is so imperfect. You don't kill people with an imperfect system.
No.
To me, that's not humane at all.
You're right. What are your thoughts on these mass incarceration? What are your thoughts on the so many people being put in prison for life and life without parole? Some wrongfully convicted, first-time offenders who have never been in trouble before, you know, and addicts, mental illnesses. We have an epidemic in this country of mental illnesses and addictions, but yet instead of treating them in facilities, they're just throwing them all in prison and throwing the key away.
Well, so views about things that are going on are very – so first, I am very open with the way I feel about what's going on in this country. And I can tell you what my views are and why I have those views. And if you look at it – so when I look at things from my viewpoint, it makes perfect sense. And so let me explain what I mean by that. This country was built on slavery. So the goal when this country was founded was to use black people to make money, and this country, the people in this country did not care whether they worked slaves to death, as long as they were making money. So if you have a country that's built on that, and then over several hundred years slavery becomes illegal, you still have that same mentality and those same systems in place. So my position is that the criminal justice system is meant to re-enslave black people. And so if it's meant to re-enslave black people, when you have a black person that steals a car and you give them life, while that is harsh, it achieves the goal of re-enslaving black people. When that person is in prison for life, you have parents, relatives giving them commissary, paying for clothes to the state, paying for phone calls, paying for, now they have movies in jail. So you are still making money off of that person. And then any work that they're doing while they're in the jail, you don't have to pay a minimum wage. So if you look at it from the perspective of that, the goal of this country is to make money off of black people, then giving someone life for stealing a car makes sense if that's the goal. So even though my viewpoint, when you look at everything that is happening, it is harsh, but it's not if your goal is to re-enslave black people. And that is what I feel the systems that are in this country that were put in place, that is the goal. So that's why you have to get people in power that recognize this and tear down these systems. And so, putting people on probation forever. If you have to let somebody out of jail that we wanted to be a slave, then supervising them forever. So when they miss an appointment with a probation officer because they don't have a vehicle, and they don't have a job because you gave them a felony so they can't get one, then they're going to go back to jail. Then they are inevitably going back to jail. And that's where we make money. And that's
hence high recidivism rates.
Yes. So to be honest, I know, and see, when I hear people talk about, we shouldn't be sending people to jail for, these minor crimes or sending them to jail for life. Yes, if the goal is truly to help people, but if the goal is to re-enslave black people, then that's exactly what you do. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that's my position. I know it's that's just the way I think. So it's like we jump up and down about everything that's wrong, but really you have to destroy the system, and you have to get rid of the people that don't see it, don't have that mentality. If you're just trying to make things better, ultimately things are going to revert back to what – that's where systemic racism comes from. These systems that were in place were built during the time of slavery. And when you can't put black people in chains, we'll put them in cells,
And I notice what they're doing with a lot of people of color, too, incarcerated, is preventing them from taking any kind of educational or higher educational or correspondence courses or even work programs. They try to prevent them from doing anything productive so that when they go before the parole board, they have nothing to show for it. And I think this is cruel. And so many people that have had to go through that, when they file lawsuits and they can't get a lawyer, some of them have actually tried to file the suits and manage it on their own. What I've known a Department of Corrections to do in a particular case one time was to throw the individual months into the lawsuit, to throw the individual into the hole, into solitary confinement, file a motion to have his case dismissed, his lawsuit dismissed. Once dismissed, letting him out. After they let him out, that individual wanted to try to, when he found out what was going on, wanted to try to file a motion with the court to appeal the court's decision. And this happened when the coronavirus came out. So what they did, they put him in on a restrictive block. They put him in the cell. And it's going on now 2.5 years that he's been in the cell 22 hours a day, 1 hour out in the morning and 1 hour out in the afternoon instead of evening. And this way he's in the cell for like 18 to 20 hours. And it's ridiculous what they're doing. But when these things happen, and this is a person of color, when these things happen, This is where ACLU should step in, and they don't. This is where some of these, even civil rights organizations in the various states, they should step in, but they don't. But this, I think, is so cruel and unusual treatment, as they say. Other countries have talked about their programs. Some of our legislative members have actually gone to Norway and have actually gone to some of these countries to find out why they're so successful. But the thing is, they don't follow suit. Other countries, like Marion Jacobs said from the Netherlands, she said their prisons treat their prisoners humane. They treat them like people, not numbers. You know, they have proper programs and things. I don't know why this country is so adamant to not follow suit with other countries. It's almost like they want to be the big shots. They want to do it their way, and they don't want to feel or let people think that they don't know what they're doing. So rather than look at all these other countries, they continue with their ignorance, their mass incarceration, their modern-day slavery, all these abuses that they're doing, all these deprivations, provocations, medical, psychological, spiritual neglect. They're doing it all.
There are countries that have, instead of jail cells, their jails look like college dormitories where people have doors. They have beds. They have things that make you feel like you're a human being. So, again, the purpose of the jails in this country are to dehumanize the people that go in there. You put them in solitary confinement so that when they can't come out, they are not successful. Just like, you know, on the plantation, they had the hot box. So they don't care. You know, anything that they can, any type of psychological damage they can do or physical damage they can do, or even just murder, if they can get away with it, it all mirrors what was going on during slavery. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. I can't, you know, and so other countries are doing things different because this is a country, again, where blacks were bought here as slaves, and this country just cannot get over what it has tried to do, so they continue to try to do it. And if we get rid of the jail cells, unless you get people in place that understand that you don't have to have bars to keep people confined, they can actually have a door and a bed that's not on the ground. You know, they can have privacy when they use the bathroom instead of having to use the bathroom in front of 10 or 15 other men, and just treat them like human beings. But again, the way this country was built, we want to dehumanize black people. So we're going to make them use the bathroom in front of 20 other inmates. That's part of the dehumanization process. We're going to make sure they have solitary confinement because we know that messes with their mind. So I don't feel, you know, the way I look at things, what the jail system is doing in this country is what it was designed to do. And so you have to get rid of it altogether. You have to get rid of the people that are in place that will not recognize that this is slavery.
Exactly. And the thing is, we still have our own people who are being divided. You know, that's the one thing that has not completely disappeared either, because they always know how to keep us divided. And what they do is they will clutch on to some people of color that have something to offer them, you know, that have some connections where they can work through them to get others to do things their way. And this is sad because, unfortunately, we have our red, brown, black, and beige in this country who, some of them, when they get to be in a certain position, they forget where they came from, and they will turn against their own. This is division.
Yeah.
And this is what we have to watch out for, too, because if we don't, I started a petition on change.org to replace prisons with long-term residential treatment facilities. A lot of people think by long-term residential treatment facilities, it means that they're going to go into these programs for a year or two. But I say, no, they can be in for 20 or 25 years, but they're getting the treatment that they need. And these facilities, when they establish these long-term residential treatment facilities for anger management or for substances or for mental health, they could expand on it. They could make it extensive with social workers, substance abuse counselors, mental health counselors. They can be different facilities, or they can be all combined in one and let it be, if it has to be for 20, 25 years, they're getting the treatment that they need. Rather than put them in for a life or life without and give them nothing, mistreat them. One prisoner, they actually damaged his shoulder permanently. He was supposed to go in for minor surgery, and this is the one with the lawsuit. They removed all the cartilage and part of his collarbone in his shoulder, part of his in his one of his knees, all the cartilage. This person was all his life. He was exercising. He was lifting weights. That was all. He was about college, lifting weights, working, you know, and they took everything from him. Now he's permanently damaged. These things here are happening in the Department of Corrections where they're supposed to make things better. Instead, they're making them worse, as you say, to keep them incarcerated. To keep them
right.
incarcerated.
And, I think what you talked about is actually an excellent idea. If you're going to have people in custody for a number, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, put them in a facility that's going to help them.
Exactly.
And in a facility that's going to help them and a facility that's going to, you know, treat them like they're human beings. So the real issue is that these systems that are in place, I mean, you have these prisons, they have these private prisons. They're multi-billion-dollar prisons, and people are making a lot of money off of people going to, you know, off of black people going to prison. So if you, in order to get rid of prisons the way they are in the privatization of prisons, you would like a lot of people, a lot of Wall Street investors, billionaires, would get upset. So there would be a lot of backlash, but it needs to be done.
And that's what Marion Jacobs, the psychosocial therapist, talks about as well. These large corporations that are benefiting off of these incarcerated populations. But it's just sad. With that petition, there's 600 and something signatures. But I assumed when I first started it, there's 2.3 million people incarcerated, men, women, and youth, in this country. You would think that there would have been a heck of a lot more than 600 and something signatures. That's why I say people talk about all the injustice, and they're just in disagreement with the things that are going on in the prisons, but yet they don't sign the petition. And that doesn't make sense. It doesn't. I don't know if they don't want their loved ones to feel like they're psychologically ill or what, but they're getting the treatment and they're getting out a lot sooner than many of them would normally.
Right, and I think, you know, a lot of times, too, you have mentioned how there's a lot of black people that just, they don't do what they're supposed to do, or they get bought off, basically. And unfortunately, there's, I would say, like 80% of the black people that get into any position of power are then bought off. They're like, well, don't protest against this, or we're going to cut your salary, or we're going to take your position away, or we're going to do this. And so they just sit, and they're complacent and compliant, and they don't do anything. And a lot of black people just don't know where, like, as far as the petition, you know, we don't got involved in politics and, just last year. So, and I've been doing this for a long, I've been a lawyer for a long time, but I haven't really gotten into politics and, like making policy changes or trying to effectuate policy changes until last year. So that's another thing. We just have to get more involved in government.
Yes. I hope you further that. I hope you actually try to get one of these positions as a state rep. I'm telling you, you'd be perfect. You would be perfect because you know what you're talking about and you know the pros and cons of it.
Right. Yeah. So I did run for Commonwealth Attorney last year. I plan on running in 4 more years, but I have to get my name out there so that people know who I am and what I stand for. So that's what I plan on doing over the next 4 years. But the Commonwealth Attorney's position is very powerful. They decide who gets charged and who doesn't.
I think that is excellent. And let me know when you do run, because I will myself promote it. I will make sure it gets out there. Right now, it's it really needs people that are honest, people that are focused, people that are, you know, familiar with the problems. And sometimes we get people in politics that have never been there, never done it. I tell everyone, even with in social work, when they go to college for social work, they don't teach us. They don't teach people about cultures. Unless you're familiar with cultures, they don't teach you about cultures. A lot of these young people come out of college and they get involved with CPS, Children's Protective, or Department of Social Services. They go into these homes, of these dysfunctional homes, with people, and they don't have, these social workers are not married. They don't have children. They come from prominent backgrounds, and they're going into the homes to tell these people what they want them to do when they have never experienced what those people are going through. And that's why I think there's so many care and protection petitions put out there, so many children being removed from the home and put in foster care. And what happens a lot of times when these kids are put in foster care? They're violated or they're abused. Some of them have been murdered. You know, and not that all foster parents are bad, but there are a few that are out for the money, not for the caring and protecting of these children. It's like substance abuse.
Right.
Because if they've never done it, if they never drank or drugged and overcame it, how can anybody help somebody that's addicted when they haven't been there, haven't done it? And mental illnesses, the same. A lot of Jeopardy, I watch that sometimes, and there's a woman on there who is a neurosurgeon, I think a psycho-neurosurgeon or something, and she was saying that she wanted to, they if you work for them, do Jeopardy to replace Alex Trebek for a week, they will donate to your cause, whatever cause you're for. And she was for the mental health facility, and she said because she had someone in her family that was, you know, suffered from mental illnesses. So the addiction and the illnesses, mental illnesses, are all over the country, whether it be in poverty-stricken homes or even the elite homes. It's there.
I have a son that has that suffers from both mental health. He has bipolar disorder and also substance addiction, which generally, unfortunately, go together.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been involved in the criminal, I don't call it the criminal justice system, but the criminal system. And because of the things that I know and my advocacy for him, he has definitely, what can I say? He has not been treated the way the average black male has been treated. And what I mean by that is he has committed at least 6 felonies. And when I say he's committed these felonies, I don't mean that he was mistakenly, like it was misidentified. He actually, he earned these 6 felonies. He has not been convicted of 1 felony, but not because of anything that, you know, not because he didn't do it, but because I stand up for him. I represent him. He's getting pretty much it's like getting white privilege without being white. All the prosecutors that were prosecuting him, I knew. So, you know, and that's just the way it is. But the bottom line is he's dealing with mental health, substance addiction, and he has a criminal record. But, of course, the fact that he doesn't have any felony convictions just means that if they can do it for my black child, they can drop and reduce charges for other black children as well. Even if they're guilty, you know, that happens. That happens a lot. It happens a lot in the white community. You know, we see it on television where they drop, you know, felony charges, dismiss them or reduce them so that people can walk free.
And I'm glad you shared that with me and shared it with us, because I'll tell you why. A lot of times there's politicians, legislative members in government who have loved ones who have either been incarcerated or they've committed a crime, or they have a disability, and
mm-hmm.
we have a state rep in the state of Massachusetts who she has loved ones that have been in prison, but she also had a brother that was murdered, and she is working with other legislative members right now to abolish life sentences and life without parole sentencing. Now this is somebody that lost her brother to a murder. And her name is State Representative Liz Miranda, and she is mm-hmm. She is totally against life and life without parole sentences. But we have a governor in Massachusetts whose son, they had to land the plane because his son was attempting a sexual assault on a female. They had to land the plane. The state troopers took him off the grounds, And that was the end of it. No one ever heard of it. So when we had a, and she was of color, and she is of color, mm-hmm. she just worked for President Biden's thing, but Rachel Rollins, who was a DA, and she wasn't for arresting and putting people into prison for drugs, for addictions. She was about getting them treatment, putting them in a facility where they get the treatment. So when the governor and law enforcement said she was being too lenient, she came right out in public and told the governor, not all young people have the privilege of having the last name of Baker. Because mm-hmm. she was letting him know that his own son, his own child, got in some trouble and got away with it when anyone else would have gone to prison.
Yeah.
So speaking of the penal system, a friend of mine sent me an email the other day. Her brother was incarcerated in Massachusetts, and he spent 28 years in prison. He was blind, and
mm-hmm.
by his own hand in commission of his crime, burned over 67% of his body. He went to prison this way. He was assaulted multiple times, thrown in the hole for months at a time, medically abused, taunted for his disfigurement, pushed off the sidewalk while passing guards. This was denied accommodations, had his finger amputated subsequent to deliberate bending of the wires in his digits. Blind and burned. Shackled, he went to the hospital. While in the hospital, blind and burned, dying, they had him shackled to the bed. He had a stroke, and that's why he went to the hospital. They had him shackled to the bed, and the stroke left him paralyzed on his left side. Now, how in the world, and they told her she could go to visit her brother because he was dying. When she gets to the hospital, they denied her. They told her to come back the next day. He died two hours later. These are some of the inhumane things that are done by barbarian correctional officers and prison officials. And we have legislative members that need to do something about it. And that's why I say they need people like you. And I hope Attorney Matheny Willard, I hope that you will. I hope that you will follow that path, because it's people like you that we need in politics. We really do. And I want you I want you to give the audience too any information you want them to have, your website, your Facebook page, whatever it is that you want to put out there, please let the audience know now. And then again, before we end the show, I'd like to have you do it again.
Okay. My name is Amina Matheny Willard. My website is www.aminalaw.com. And my email address is amina@aminalaw.com. My telephone number is 757-777-3441.
Great. Thank you so much. And again, as I said, before the end of the show, I'd like to have you just do it again, make sure that they have the correct information. And I understand, too, now, she's not on the show with us, but you have a twin sister who is your paralegal?
Yes, I do.
And that is what makes you so unique.
Yes, so she actually, and this, it's actually recent. Is she, let me see if she, did she not, she didn't call in?
No, she might have forgotten. But it's very unusual to have an attorney and a paralegal working together and to have them as twin sisters.
Yeah, so I'll tell you how that happened. My sister, so I'm going to go back to when I was in law school. So about 21 years ago, while I was in law school, when I went to law school, my sister calls me after I'm in there for like a month. She calls me and tells me that she is joining the circus. when I left, she was a teacher she taught elementary school students dance. So it was a private school, and she taught the dance classes in the school. Well, she took her children on a field trip to Ringling Brothers Circus when it was here in Norfolk, Virginia, and they were having auditions for dancers. And so she auditioned during that field trip, and she was hired as a dancer for Ringling Brothers. And so when the circus left, she left. She traveled with Ringling Brothers Circus, and she was also with Universal Circus. She was a tiger trainer. She trained dogs. She worked with the horses. She worked with elephants. And she did, like, you know, she and pretty much like dancing all around the different performers. So she had kids along, you know, she had two children, and they were being, she was doing homeschooling. But recently, within the past year, she decided to kind of settle down, buy a house, and they went to school. They're in public school. So about when I went into, private practice most recently, February of last year, and about 2 or 3 months ago, I was like, I need a paralegal. And I was like, I need somebody who is I was talking to my husband. I was like, I need somebody who can understand everything that I'm doing and just, you know, really work really hard at it. And I was like, I'm going to call my sister. So that's actually how it happened. I was talking to my husband about the fact that I needed somebody who could help, because she's at home. She was a stay-at-home mom now. And I'm like, she's not doing anything. Let me call her. And I called her, and she has been awesome.
It is. It's an awesome thing when you can actually – and sometimes they just enjoy working with their sibling. A lot of times they enjoy working with their sibling, and they want to do, you know, they want to keep going and keep going. It's good that happened. I've never seen it or heard of it before.
Yeah, she's just as vested in my clients as I am. But let me tell you what she did. She still doesn't know this because I forgot to tell her about this, but she schedules all of my appointments. So yesterday I met with an attorney that's working on a case here in Hampton Roads that's also in the news, and we were kind of collaborating. So when I went over to meet with him, we decided to have a working lunch. While we were walking to the restaurant, he's like, your sister told me that she wants to make sure that you know that I know that she's 10 minutes older than you. But she is the oldest sister. So she just wanted to make sure that I knew that.
That's like being in high school. A friend of mine, when we were in high school, was a couple of days younger than me, and she used to always call me an old lady because I was 2 days older than her. But she wasn't a relative.
Right.
But I was going to say, there's a lot of prisoner advocacy groups and organizations in the Virginia area. Do you connect with any of them?
Yes, I connect with there's a lot of community leaders that I talk to, and we try to collaborate together. I'm getting this plan of giving one of the community leaders had the plan of giving school-age children a little index card that they can carry in their pocket in case, you know, the principal calls them to the office. They take it out and say, I don't want to make any statements. And we're going to try to start, you know, putting that out there for kids to do and parents to teach their kids to do. But in this area, the sad thing, we have NAACP in Norfolk. They do not help. They do not speak out. Let me just say, the organizations that you would think would help, they don't.
I talk about that all the time, and I'm sure that NAACP is not too fond of me. But I, you know, they used to at one time. They were really good, but like other organizations and groups, they kind of like fell behind. And we need a lot of young people of color. They need people like the NAACP. They need people like Al Sharpton, you know, National Action Network. These are the role models that they no longer have to look up to or no longer have out there to help them with the school-to-prison pipeline and even those who have ended up in prison. So I know a lot of people I've heard from a lot of others, including prisoners, that they don't have any use anymore for these organizations that were once there and no longer care. And that's the sad thing about it.
Yeah, and what's even more concerning is that they have a name. So the NAACP here, they don't do anything, but they have a name. So if they were to speak up against the injustice, even if they just put out a press release and it says, like, the NAACP, you know, is against Vincent Taco violently punching Ebony Holmes in the face, just do that. Like, type up a sentence and send it to the news. Can you do that? They won't do that. You know,
mm-hmm.
So in the news, because of the name of NAACP, they have an automatic audience when they send out a press release. But they won't do it, you know?
Yeah.
So
there's
that.
There are groups like that.
So it's horrible.
You know, if they were to go to these community colleges, go to the high school, talk to these kids, you know, let them know when they go there to, you know, what they would like to have them do, and to give them an arena that they can come to if they have problems or if they want to talk to the people at NAACP or National Action Network or any lawyer at all, to go to these schools, especially these kids that are getting ready to go to college to prepare for law school or to prepare for psychology or social work or whatever, you know, prepare them. Go talk to them in the auditorium, or go talk to them in the community college. But let them know that you're watching. Let them know that you care, that you want to help them before, because these kids are transitioning from children to adolescent to young adults. They don't know what they're going to do when they get ready to graduate from high school. And unfortunately, there's a lot of young people of color that get told by their own teachers that they're not going to make anything of themselves. So a lot of them drop out of school. And at one time they could drop out of school and they could join the military, but now they can't join the military unless they are high school graduates. So these teachers also have to be overseen and taught not to talk down to these kids, not to teach them that they're not going to do anything or be anything with themselves. You said that you were one of them?
When I went to I graduated when I was 16 from Booker T. Washington High School. So I was in my 12th grade year, and I had a guidance counselor that was black, and I told them that I wanted to go to law school. And they were like, well, you don't have the money to go to law school. At that time I was talking about college. I wanted to go to college, then I wanted to go to law school. You don't have the money. You're not going to be able to make it. Maybe you should think about taking up a trade or something, they said. So the truth is I didn't have the money to go to law school, but that has never stopped me. So what I ended up doing when I was 16 years old, when she said that, that really kind of pissed me off, because I was like, it worked, I guess, the opposite way. It didn't discourage me. It made me want to go
even more.
So what I had to do when I was 16 years old, my mother was receiving welfare, and I was graduating from – the reason I was graduating from college, from high school at 16, is because I had skipped – my mother skipped me and my sister through the fifth grade, and then when I got into the ninth grade, I ended up going to night school, summer school, and I skipped the 10th grade on my own. So that's why I was 16. So when I was 16 years old, I wanted to go to New York University when I graduated from Booker T. Washington. Well, because my mom was on welfare, I didn't have the money to go, and she wasn't able to sign the student loan paperwork as a I could sign it as a student without any money, but if she signed it, they looked at her credit. That's pretty much how it was. So what I had to do was I got emancipated. So I went to the Norfolk Juvenile Domestic Relations Court, got emancipated when I was 16. And in order to get emancipated, you just had to show that you were taking care of yourself. Well, it just so happened that when I turned 15, I moved out of the house with my mom, and I was taking care of myself. She was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I had moved here to Norfolk, Virginia. Her and my sister stayed in Pittsburgh. I moved here to Norfolk, Virginia, and I was staying at a rooming house for Norfolk State University students. And I was renting a room, and I was going, and I was working at two McDonald's while I was in school when I was 15 and 16 years old. So the court was able to determine that I've been taking my care of myself for the past year. They emancipated me. So when they emancipated me, I was able to sign my own student loans to go to New York University. So I went to New York University, and then I graduated. Instead of 4 years, I graduated in three. And
wow.
Then I graduated from there when I was 19. And then I ended up going to law school. But I never will forget that guidance counselor who, and she was right, I couldn't afford it, but it didn't matter because I went anyway. But in the normal course of things, yeah, you're not going to be able to afford to go to college when your mom's on welfare and you're working at McDonald's. So
but
I just made it, God made it work.
Things like that, the teacher should have did some research because I noticed there is so much available to people out there if they do the research. There's so many philanthropists that would have funded you. There's so many people, you know, that have the money that would help people at that time like yourself. I was going to say, we have a caller, and it may be your sister, 469. Would you like to say something?
Yeah, that is.
Hi.
That's my sister.
Yes, this is Amira. I am here. How is everyone today?
Very good. How are you, Amira? I wanted to ask
I'm
you.
I'm excellent. Thank you
I
so much.
I wanted to ask you and your sister, Amina, have you girls thought about writing a book? Have you written any books, published any books?
No.
I have, you know, I have not, and we talk about it kind of jokingly, but I definitely think both of our lives would be really good reads. That might be something we can sit down and do,
you know
collectively.
I'm listening to a story that started out with welfare and ended up with skipping a grade and graduating. I'm listening to all of these things happening, and I'm saying I'm surprised that there has been no book written by you girls because it's such a unique situation. And Amina, you are so determined to become not only the attorney that you are, but also even going further into politics. And Amira, it's just amazing. I just think you girls should be considering authoring and writing and authoring a book, whether it be together or whether it be separate ones. But you both have an awesome story to tell.
Thank you so much. That's definitely, like I said, you know, when you look back at everything and the way things are now and what we've gone through and accomplished, and it would definitely be newsworthy, or like I said, a definitely good read or how-to book, you know, motivator, keep people pushing for things that other people tell them are not possible. You know, anything is possible, and I think we're both proof of that.
Yeah.
Right.
And I wanted to bring up something as well, and I have new vision. Can you girls continue to talk, and I just want to get this call?
Yes, sure.
Well, yes, ma'am.
So I was telling her when that mommy was on welfare when I went to college.
Yes.
But I didn't tell her that we didn't. Yeah, you're able to hear it. But I didn't tell her that we didn't know for the longest time that mommy was on welfare, right? Do you remember that?
Well, this is what I'm going to say to you. I did not know that. I am learning that now, but I guess you were probably more in tune to that because of what you were trying to do. Right? So when you were saying that and I was listening to it, huh?
You didn't know that even all
well,
the time?
Well, she's older than you. That's why. how many minutes?
Well, I'm the oldest one, and I didn't even know. 10 minutes. Yeah,
are
no,
you just
that's what I was
that
saying. When she was just telling that story, I was like, we go on welfare? Really?
I think back then a lot of people were, but.
Let me tell you what happened. But you know, y'all were, you and mommy were living in Pittsburgh and I was in Virginia. Mommy came down to visit me one time, and I needed some groceries, and she pulled out the food stamp card. I had never, I mean, the food stamp, it wasn't a card, it was booklet. And I was like, what is this? And she's like, they're food stamps. I was like, what does that mean? She said, you can get food with it. Do you have any problems using it? I was like, no, but okay. But
now they call
my mom.
Now they call them EBT. Now they call them EBT.
I think she was trying to hide it from us. I think she was trying to hide it from us because she was ashamed. But I needed food, and I guess that's all she had. That's the only way I found out that we were on welfare, which obviously I didn't have a problem with. I needed the food, and it got the food. I didn't have a problem, you know.
What I think is a problem with a lot of people in this country, especially people of color, is the pride. We are so proud, you know, and I guess maybe from slavery time, you know, but there's so many people, especially of color, that are so proud, they don't want to accept things. And I remember years ago when I was in my 20s, I think, I worked for this very wealthy couple on Cape Cod, which I was from Cape Cod. But the woman offered me some beautiful, beautiful clothes that she was, you know, wanting to get rid of. And I used to always say, no, no, no. And finally somebody said, Viona, take them. If you don't want them, give them to someone else. I said, it's not that I don't want them. It's that I'm too embarrassed to take it. But you know what? Now that I'm older and more experienced and have aged and the wisdom is now in my head, in my body, now I look at it and I say, people of color especially are so proud that they lose out on a lot of things too. And you lose out on a lot of things for being proud.
That is true.
And we have to stop with the pride. Just like a lot of people, I say in this country, they're very insecure. Mm-hmm. These legislative members and people in the communities that know of the injustices going on, and yet they don't want to speak out because their peers are part of it. And there's a lot of correctional officers that I've interviewed on the show. I've interviewed correctional officers that talked about the injustices in the prisons when they were working there, but they were the brave ones that came forward. A lieutenant from the DOC in Montana, Michael Johnson, and DJ Vodica from California, a 14-year veteran who turned against his peers because of the injustices going on. These are the ones that I look at as heroes. Well, we have so many guards inside correctional offices that have actually said something to prisoners about the injustices they see, but they're too afraid to speak out. So what do a lot of people say?
Right. Nobody wants to be the squeaky wheel.
Mm-hmm. You know, exactly. But real quickly, what I wanted to say too to both of you is, I don't know if you thought about it, Attorney, but places like Harvard and all these law schools across the country, there's a lot of students that are going to school for law or paralegal, mm-hmm. and they are just looking to work in organizations with attorneys so that they can get that, get the experience or do their internship. It might be a good thing to, you know, even if it's just the law schools in Virginia, but to get them involved with what you're doing too, and then start going around to some of these community colleges and schools and talking about some of mm-hmm. these that go on in the communities, in the system, and the school to prison pipeline. Some of these things would be so instrumental in helping these young people in these lost years.
I think that's and a great
a lot
idea.
Of people
I
don't
just
know.
Want to educate people.
Yeah.
Would you say that?
Yeah. I was saying a lot of people just don't know what's going on. They, you know, either they don't want to know or they don't want to see it, or in truth, it's shielded from them because they, you know, have their heads buried in whatever else it is they're dealing with. So
yeah. A lot is kept from them.
Definitely
so they
getting the message out.
And that's the whole purpose of the show and other radio shows that are out there on Facebook, too, is to bring awareness to the public. Because we always, when we were growing up, we always thought the police were, you know, the good guys, and we could look up to them, and we could, as a matter of fact, my father even worked, he worked in the yard, the landscape and gardening for the chief of police, where we grew up. and he had an excellent reputation. But they hid, my mother and father protected us because we didn't know how serious racial issues were until we got older, you know, and our children, they start having to experience it. Like my son, when he went to college, that's when, or after high school, that's when he started seeing a lot of it. And unfortunately, young men of color, black men, they suffer more even than the women because.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Well,
yeah.
You, go ahead. Because you said you're going to say because.
No, it's just that they are, even when they are violated as children. You know, they say the girls, when they're violated, you know, it's bad enough. But when a young boy is violated, then it's even worse because they feel like, you know, they feel like they're responsible for one thing, and they feel like, you know, it's taken away from their manhood. There's a lot of things that
yep.
these young men and women go through, and it's sad. But that's why we need people like yourselves, lawyers and paralegals, that know from experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of, you know, I've had thousands and thousands of clients over the years. So I, you know, experience the racism, the harshness of jail just through my clients, you know, and my son as well. You know, when you have the perspective of a parent who has a child or a young adult in jail or even an adult, when my son called me from jail, I asked him the name of his roommate or his cellmate. I look up his cellmate. Now, my son is like 110 pounds and like 5'2".
Hmm.
I look up his cellmate, and his cellmate is charged with murder.
Mm-mm.
So, obviously, I'm concerned, you know? Like, first of all, what? You know, that's things that people don't think about. When you put somebody in jail, they have to worry about who their cellmate is. He got into a fight because I gave him commissary. So where he was, they were feeding them at 4:30 in the morning and 4:30 at night. That's it. So in order to eat in between time, your family members had to get commissary. Well, he got commissary every single day. He got donuts in the morning. I sent him pizza and chicken wings at night. And then I gave him... You get like a chip box and all that kind of stuff. So somebody beat him up because they wanted his food. You know, so these are things that have nothing to do with why you're in jail. So you
now,
steal a pack of gum.
Was he in jail? Was he in a jail or a prison?
Jail.
Oh, okay.
He was in the local Virginia Beach City jail.
I wanted to ask your thoughts on both of you, on your thoughts on this. First of all, I think they should incarcerate individuals according to the crimes, or you know, in instead of mixing them all in, they do this in the jails and the prisons and everything. They put people, serial killers and terrorists, they put them all in the same environment. I don't think,
mm-hmm.
and also
yeah.
I noticed there's a large population of empty cells in these prisons across the country, but yet they're packing them in and making them double cell. And a lot of people have been written up so many times because they refuse to double cell. So even though they have their single cell status, they still have all these disciplinary reports that are not making them look good at all. But I don't think that anybody, especially if they're in for a long time, I don't think anybody should have to be double celled with another prisoner. I really don't believe it. And as you said
what?
Earlier, Amina, the prisons are designed to make money and to keep their
yeah,
slavery
right.
mentality. And I think that's the whole purpose. That's the whole reason they do this.
They don't care.
Yep.
The more you can get in there, the less money. I mean, the more money they make. You can get five people in one cell. That's better. They build them as high as possible so they can stack them. Literally, use bunk beds and stack them. So yeah, they don't care. They're gonna fit you. They're gonna fit you where they can fit you. I'm gonna tell you another thing. And a lot of my stories come from talking to my son. But when he first got there, he was in the hall. He was in a cot in a hall because they didn't have any rooms in any of the cells, which he didn't mind. Obviously, it was a hall between, I guess, the cells and the outside. So there were still there.
I guess it, like when you go in the doors, there's a hall and then there's cells. So he was in that hall. So obviously he didn't mind. But again, the jail was overcrowded. They didn't have a place for him. And then they put him in a cell with somebody who committed murder. So there's that.
That's what I say.
But
I think
those are things that people don't think about, you know?
No. They need to replace these prisons with long-term residential treatment. I want to say we've got about 5 minutes left, so I want you girls again to give your information, and I would love to have you back on the show again. I mean, really, just for an update, maybe in another few weeks or so. But if you can,
anytime.
I would love to have you both back on again. And if you want to, once again, give your information to everyone, and if there's anything you want the audience to know, please feel free to say it.
Okay. My name is Amina Matheny-Willard. My website is www.aminalaw.com. My email address is amina@aminalaw.com, and my office number is 757-777-3441. And I do plan on putting things on my website to help people when they go to court. So hopefully within the next month or two, I'll have that updated.
And your Facebook.
Right. My Facebook, if you search for my name on my Facebook, you can go to my Facebook page as well. It's Amina, A-M-I-N-A. My last name is Matheny Willard, M-A-T-H-E-N-Y hyphen Willard, W-I-L-L-A-R-D. And I am, if you go to my Facebook page, you know, I'm reading a Willie Lynch book up there about slavery. So there's a... There's a lot that you'll see on my Facebook page.
Okay.
Amir, you want to give them your
information?
Oh,
maybe your name,
sure.
Your email address.
Okay. Being a part of aminalaw.com, you can also reach me at 757-777-3441. If I'm not able to answer, just leave a message, and I will get back with you as soon as possible. Also on the Facebook with Amina at aminalaw.com. I don't know. You know, I kind of function around and get everything in order and together so she can do her thing in court. And, you know, it's really exciting watching my sister work.
Do you mean that as a compliment?
No, I do. Really, really. Because in the years that we've been, and this is another story for another day, we've been apart, and I'm just recently starting to help her and get into what she is doing and seeing it. And you, the amount of people that tell me and give her praise, and they're like, oh, I love your sister. She does this. She does that. You know, I haven't seen her in court or what she does since she was in college, and I went to do a mock court with her, you know, as one of her witnesses or something like that. So I really haven't gotten a chance to experience what is Amina Matheny Willard, you know, but I hear great things, and she's doing a lot of really exciting things that I think people need to know about, especially in Norfolk. They need to look her up and follow her, and she has a lot of good information, and she helps a lot of people.
And just so everyone is clear, I'm in Norfolk, Virginia. My sister is actually in Texas. So she is my paralegal, but she works remotely.
You know,
so,
everybody's working remotely these days, especially since the pandemic.
Yes.
But a lot of the lawyers are working remotely as well. I noticed that even my organization, you know, we do virtual work. But,
Yes.
I was going to say the end of April, the 21st to 28th, if either of those days are good for you, please let me know, and then we can set it up, because I want both of you back again. And I'll let you finish what you were saying.
Okay. You said the 21st and the 28th.
Let's see. What I have is the 7/21, April 7th, April 21st, or April 28th.
She's going straight to scheduling.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Well, can this one
if we're referring to around the same time, then the 28th would be good.
Okay, just send me an email and or a message, and then I can set it up, and then we can I take it from there. And I will make sure you get your invitations next time. But again, I want to thank both of you for coming on. You've been a blessing. You've been enjoyable. I find you both so unique and humble. And I just want the audience to know, please tune in when we have them on again, because this is awesome. And any time that you ever want to come on the show after the next one, just let us know, because this is what we need to do. Is we need to get more information out. We need to find more attorneys like yourselves that are doing good, paralegals. And whatever you do, I hope that God goes with you, because you are both beautiful people. Thank you so much for being on the show. And I look forward to having you.
Thank you.
And listen to your big sister.
I will.
Exactly. I've been saying that for I don't know how many years. I'm not going to tell her age, but I've been saying that for a long time.
Thank you, Attorney Matheny, Willard, and also thank you, Amira, paralegal. Thank you both for coming on. Audience, I want to thank you for listening in, and I hope that you will listen on next Wednesday when we have Marion Jacobs on, and also next Tuesday when we have an open discussion for anyone that wants to call in to talk about anything, any of the injustices going on in this country, behind those prison walls and in the communities. We welcome you to join us on Tuesdays. Call-in number is 657-383-1630. And again, it's at 12 o'clock Eastern Time to 1:30. So please call in if you have any issues you'd like to discuss. And attorney and paralegal, I thank you once again. It's been a blessing.
Thank you for having us. You have a blessed day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks.